Okay, I want you to picture something. You're at a restaurant next to a couple on a first date. Heterosexual couple. Bottle of wine, romantic lighting. They're smiling and talking, leaning in close. Got it? Now, quick question. Who is laughing more? The man or the woman? The answer to that question might say more about gender expectations than who is funnier and how much it matters to the long-term success of this relationship. That's according to a new study out of KU. I'm Gina Kaufman. This is KCUR's Central Standard. And Jeffrey Hall is with us now. He is a KU professor of communication studies. Hi, Jeffrey.
It's great to be back.
What exactly did you study and what were your findings?
So what I studied is, what is the role of producing humor and also of appreciating a partner's humor in long-term relationship satisfaction? And again, as you mentioned, for heterosexual couples. And the idea here is that we're really trying to tease apart something that's a dynamic that appears in courtship that you just described. And how does that actually look in a long-term relationship, one that lasts, you know, 10 years and more? So the two parts of the study, the first one really looked at combining research from several different studies. And this was what's called a meta-analysis. In that study, there were over 2,100 people who are in long-term relationships, and we had husband and wife pairs. They were in their 30s, and they had been married for about 9 years on average. And what we looked at is when men and women reported their own humor production, and they also perceived it in their partner, I was looking for whether or not there was a sex difference between whether or not that was more strongly associated with their relationship satisfaction. So in the case of women and men, it was equivalent. If they thought their partner was very, very funny, they tended to be in a happier relationship. And that makes sense. There's been a lot of research over time that it really confirms the idea that perceiving your partner has a great sense of humor tends to be something that's a benefit to your long-term relationship. But the real kicker comes in with something that's called a partner effect. This happens when one person's humor is associated with their partner's contentment. So this is the idea that you have two people who are in the same study who are married to one another. So in this case, the partner's tendency to joke and then their partner's relationship satisfaction, which was reported independently. What's really interesting here is that when women had husbands who had a lot, who were reporting themselves to have a lot of humor, producing a lot of humor.
The self-reporting of your own sense of humor is a sticking point for me, but go on.
Totally. No, and we'll get back to that for sure. And then we also had when that happened, there was a very small association. But when men had women who were self-reporting themselves to have a lot, producing a lot of humor, it was three times larger, more strongly associated with their relationship satisfaction. So what that means is that in the courtship stage, women are overvaluing men's comedic skill, while men are undervaluing women's when it comes to what's going to happen in a long-term relationship.
Okay. Can we put that just in plain language? Because I feel like...
Yeah.
I understand why you're being careful with your words, but I want to make sure that this also is like clear. Basically, if I am getting this right, you're saying that in the courtship stage of a relationship between heterosexual partners, that the woman thinks that the man's humor is going to be really, really important in this relationship. And it might be important, but maybe not as important as she thinks it is, statistically speaking. Whereas... the man might think humor is not such a big deal, when in fact it's going to be a very big deal to whether he's happy in this relationship.
You got it. You summarized it even better than I did. What I would add to that is what's fascinating about this is it really goes to sort of, there's been 10 years of research that's trying to understand that very dynamic. And the dynamic is that men tend to be the jokers during the first stages of courtship, and women tend to laugh or receptive to humor, particularly in that sort of dynamic to show that they're interested in the man continuing to talk, enjoy his sense of humor. What's also interesting is that this happens in observational studies. So your question with self-report, I think, is very apt. But what this really means is that if they do studies where you take recordings of people who are interacting in natural settings or on first dates, people who are first getting to know each other or people who are out together. And so all of these different sort of techniques have found that there's this imbalance where men seem to be cracking more jokes and women tend to be more likely to be receiving that humor through laughter and that kind of behavior. So this also happens when people try to say, what do you want in a partner? And women, more so than men, are saying, I'm looking for a guy who can make jokes, right, can produce humor. Men, more so than women, are more likely to say, I want a partner who's receptive to my sense of humor. So this idea of appreciating versus producing is a gender dynamic that comes out in a lot of different research from very different points of view all over these studies for 10 years. And so what's fascinating is the question is why? Why is it the case that we see this happening? And what my study was really trying to say is, well, does this play out in long-term relationships? And it does completely the opposite once we get into a long-term relationship.
So are you saying that there was existing research showing what people were looking for, but then nothing beyond that to say, how does this play out?
Well, what do you find a lot in research, I find, is that there are these little camps of people who are doing different things that are related but don't really talk to each other. I actually had the fortuitousness of actually both studying flirting and studying long-term relationship humor use. So I was kind of well-positioned to say, well, wait a second here. These two camps of researchers aren't talking to each other. So there'd be research on people who are just the beginning of courtship stage, young adults, typically often college students. And then you'd have this body of research that's about people who've been married for 10, 15 years who have talk about each other's the role of humor in their relationship. But these two camps of people weren't talking to each other. And so this meta-analysis was meant to say, are the things that we want or think that we want in courtship actually playing out in long-term relationship success?
If you don't mind my asking this, why did you study any of this at all? What is the larger significance here?
Well, what's fascinating is that of the kind of traits that people talk about, or they want in a relationship, humor is tops. Like people talk over and over again about wanting a person who can make them laugh or to share a sense of humor. A shared sense of humor is so strongly associated with relationship satisfaction that it's really a key part of relationship. And part of this is that this, why that really matters goes back a long time. People talk about humor as facilitating bonding. It makes people feel closer. It makes us feel understood and included. And it also is fun. It's playful. It gives us a light sense of mood, and it's a coping strategy to deal with stressful events. So humor plays this really important role in healthy functioning and coping with stress, in having a relationship with another person, and fostering inclusion between two people. So I really wanted to understand, how does this actually come about? Is it because that people are able to make a lot of jokes, or is it because they share a sense of humor? What is the real kind of key there that brings people together?
Why do you focus on heterosexual relationships?
Frankly, it has to do with a lack of research. It's not. It's unfortunately the case that many researchers of relationship science don't focus on heterosexual and homosexual couples or gay and lesbian couples as often because of the history of sort of that branch of research. Really, we're focusing on who was available or who volunteered for the study. And for a long time, there were a lot of social stigma and also legal challenges to being married or being in a couple that was gay or lesbian. And so as a consequence, they weren't involved in studies. And since this study really looked at 10 years or 10 studies that go back years and years, there just wasn't the research
in the past. And specifically go back years and years as married couples.
That's correct. That's correct.
What does this say about gender constructs in your mind, like beyond romantic relationships?
I think what's fascinating about the gender construct part of this is it means that I think people are playing a traditional role. They're playing a script when they're in the process of flirting with one another. I think that women actually play up their laughing at men's jokes. I think they know it. You know, there's this sort of really funny bit that my wife and I share because we share a sense of humor, and one of our favorite shows is 30 Rock. And there's this great show, a part where, the main character, Liz Lemon, is doing a laugh that she sort of shows of how women sort of laugh when they're being hysterical. And so it's kind of meant to sort of be like, this is how women would play up their laughter, so sort of like make men think that they're interested.
But, it's interesting because when you talk about flirting, what that is where you can't in flirting come out and say what it is you're doing, or else that's not flirting anymore. And so you find all these other ways of saying I'm interested, and laughter could be one of those, or maybe like a certain kind of laughter, but so can facial expression, all
Sure.
kinds of body language and subtext. So it's not surprising to me that laughter would be a tool, but I had never quite realized that it's not really considered part of the man's arsenal.
That's right. Who's laughing, right? Who's doing the laughing and who's doing the joking is the question. And you're hitting on something that's really important here, which is that there are studies that look at how people create bonding or how to create social attraction between people who are both same-sex and opposite-sex pairs. And laughter and shared laughter is a critical point of that. So you're correct that shared laughter or a sense that we're joking together really bonds people together no matter who they are. In the case, though, of courtship, what I'm arguing is that heterosexual courtship is governed by particular scripts about how men and how women are supposed to behave. In that script, it's my hunch that men are acting up, basically playing up their ability to make jokes because they think that that's the role that they need to be playing, is kind of the guy who's like being suave and being intelligent and being funny and being interesting. And a woman's job is to evaluate a man's attempt to become those things and basically reinforce them through the process of laughing. And I think that that gender dynamic doesn't necessarily have to be that way. There's no reason for it to exist. But more importantly, according to my research, that gender dynamic tells us very, very little about how happy that couple will be if they actually behave that way in real life.
Yeah, it makes me think about like the difference between campaigning and governing.
I love it. I love it. Good political metaphors are always welcome here.
Okay, well, I am super curious about what the funny women out there have to say about this. Are you surprised by findings that show your sense of humor may be undervalued compared to what it adds to your actual relationships? Or does that totally sync up with your personal experience to the point that it's like, no duh, 816-235-2888 is the number to call. Jeffrey, what has been your experience as you've shared the findings? Do men and women react the same way when you state the basic results, that men undervalue women's humor and it's important to their happiness and relationships, and that women overvalue men's humor? Is everyone equally surprised or not by what you've learned?
So part of the study's motivation was about 3 or 4 years ago, I released a research study that had observational research. So this meant that 51 pairs of people came into the lab and they interacted with one another and they had just met. And then I coded whether or not that they made jokes or attempted humor and who was laughing and that kind of thing. And what I found was, unsurprisingly, again, consistent with the literature, that men were attempting jokes more and women were more likely to laugh. But what was interesting in that study was kind of the other part of it, was that when they were laughing together, it was a good predictor of both men and women's attraction to one another, so that shared laughter really mattered. When this story got picked up by the media, though, what happened is I saw headlines which were really not what I meant to say, which was that basically that funny women aren't valuable, or that, you know, men's sense of humor is the only thing that matters, and that it was really sort of taking kind of that gender stereotypical, more sexist sort of angle in interpreting the research. And I had actually a reporter call me up and says, is this really what you meant to say? And I'm like, no, not at all. Where is that coming from? And I had to find what reporter had picked it up and interpreted it in the way to kind of come to that same conclusion. So in part, the motivation for this is, once I assembled these studies for the meta-analysis, I looked at this particular possibility of, you know, this gender difference in humor production in order to clarify whether or not that was actually true in long-term relationships.
Okay, that is really a lot to digest. I mean, what do you think it says beyond its significance to romantic relationships that shared... I guess the idea of shared laughter as the real key, when we think, it's like we think we're putting on performances for an audience when really we're just finding an experience that fits. I don't know. It's kind of...
We're connecting with another person. You're right. And that connection is so critical. You know, one of the things that I like to think about here is, it doesn't really matter what your sense of humor is in a long-term romantic relationship. It matters whether you share that sense of humor with your partner. And I think that partners can have all kinds of senses of humor and ways of expressing humor that's idiosyncratic to their relationship. But the research would suggest that when people are actually sharing that construction of humor and what's funny to them, they tend to be much happier in the relationship. You know, case in point, you know, I think that things like having a common vocabulary about what's funny because you picked it up from TV or movies that you've watched together with your partner, being able to share a similar story and interpretation of what your children do, offers an opportunity to laugh again. You know, recalling something that happened before. Another one would be when you have an event that happened in the course of your day and you can't wait to share your partner with it because you thought it was funny and you can't wait to kind of tell them how kind of weird or ironic or, obviously objectively funny it was. And the idea is when you build that repartee with your partner where they share that inside language, they share that understanding of what's funny, and that's a safe place to be able to try out things which are quirky or weird or just specific to the two of you, that possibility of bonding and playfulness is what really matters.
That's going to take a while to emerge though, right?
So you mean in a couple?
Yeah.
Absolutely. It takes time to actually come up with enough of a history between the two of you that you don't get a, that you get to share those inside jokes. And that's true with friendship, right? When you have friends, you actually have to spend a lot of time with them to know what they think is funny, but also have a shared experience or a shared vocabulary to share that humor too.
So it's kind of like that old adage about romance isn't about looking into each other's eyes. It's about looking out at the world together. The same could be said about laughter. Like, ultimately, laughing and joking together is more romantic than one person being funny or not.
Exactly. And I think that you're really kind of keying in on something that's important. Someone who has a fantastic sense of humor, but their partner doesn't share it, that's not going to necessarily help the relationship. So just having a sense of humor in itself, I would argue, is not a great predictor of whether or not you're going to be happy in the relationship. Certainly if you have a sense of humor that's kind of not obviously positive and warm. Other senses of humor are dark or strange or quirky or weird. Those ones don't contribute to relationship satisfaction in a very linear way. Instead, it's a matter of building a repartee with your partner.
So, like, newsflash, the other person is also in the relationship?
You said it better than I could say it myself.
Okay, we have just a little time left for this conversation, so you have just a little time to get in on it. 816-235-2888 is the number to call to talk with Jeffrey Hall, who studied the role of humor in the long-term happiness of men versus women in heterosexual relationships. Turns out men largely undervalue the importance of women's humor, which adds more to their happiness in relationships than they realize. There's just a little time left for those calls. 816-235-2888. What do you find most interesting about your findings, Jeffrey?
Well, I'm really trying to push forward this kind of argument that we're thinking about it in terms of a traditional sexual script. I think that it'd be really healthy for our society to actually sort of break apart a lot of those elements of script. You know, I think
Right.
And I think that there is a broader argument about what might replace it. You know, I think there have been opportunities through the Me Too movement, but also through other things to think about what would be a way in which that we could flirt with one another, express our attraction to one another, express our interest in one another, that doesn't have to carry the baggage of kind of traditional roles of men and women. And
but some can of I that, push back a little bit there?
Sure.
What if by fulfilling those roles, you are saying that you are looking for someone who wants to fulfill those roles to some extent?
Yeah, you're not pushing back at all. That's the problem. That's the barrier, is that the script is kind of all we've got collectively speaking is we know what it looks like. That's why scripts are so pervasive and so hard to break. People continue to act in those ways, not because they themselves feel that way or think that it ought to be that way, but that's just what people do. So the idea of men approaching women rather than women approaching men, the idea of men buying women drinks, the idea that men should lead the conversation, all of these things are part of that sexual script. But that really paints the picture of women being passive and yielding and unable to make their own decisions or unable to lead the conversation. And all of that is nonsense. So I think that that kind of nonsense, unfortunately, gets pervasively captured by media portrayals and also gets, you know, put in people's real lives. But it really has this sort of ability to move, to not move at all, right? It has ability to stay put for what exactly you said. There isn't an alternative that is an obvious way to show your interest in someone that's not scripted.
But I am also curious about other settings where women's humor might be undervalued. For example, I mean, just in thinking about this, I think that I may use humor at times to make people comfortable in social settings. And I have seen other friends doing that too, friends who are women. I think it's very common. But you still hear this refrain that women aren't as funny as men, which is just like, have you even heard of Amy Schumer? You know what I mean?
Right. Absolutely. And this is part of kind of consumption practices. As long as the consumption practices were based on, you know, white men audiences that got to choose what's on our national television or what kind of shows are streamed or what kind of shows are even made, then you run out of a possibility of, or you just basically exclude the possibility of women comedians and otherwise being brought to the fore. And, you know, again, there's this great story that talks about what happened when the SNL group who tries out jokes became more diverse in the sense that there were more women, there were more people of color who are part of making a decision of what through the table read process got put on the Saturday Night Live show on Saturday. And once it became more diverse, there was finally an audience for the jokes. And when that audience was there, the audience allowed for the possibility of that joke to appear on television because it was an audience of comedians of color, audience of comedians that were also women. So if you don't find it funny, it has to do with who the audience is and less to do with who the comedian is.
Because funny is just not an objective thing at all.
I would argue that what's really funny for me as a person who studies humor, like based on like people interacting, when I had to go through those videos of people interacting for the first part, for the first 10 minutes of when they're getting to know each other, it is not objectively funny.
Oh my God, wait.
It's so boring.
Are you able to tell more about this?
Yeah, sure. So, you know, when I watch those 10-minute videos over and over again to code them, what's so crazy about that is the kind of things that people joke about, objectively speaking, are not funny. Like, they're not things that I would write down and, like, share with another person or think that was comic. And I would say there's only probably, like, two or three anecdotes through that all of those hours and hours of video that I watched that I like, you know, that's actually legitimately pretty funny. Because, as you said, it's not objectively a matter of what's funny or not between people. It's what's funny or not is whether or not the audience likes it, whether the audience thinks it's funny. And you and I have both, I'm sure, and many of the people in the audience have had the experience where our jokes totally fall flat, that no one thinks they're funny.
Yes, yet, sadly.
Sadly, right? But then we have an experience where our joke like totally hits with somebody and we're like, whoa, like that worked. This is amazing. So, you know, that's a good example of interpersonally, the idea that it's really, really not objectively funny interpersonally. Maybe you could argue that, you know, famous people have to be objectively funny in order to stay on stage and keep their jobs. But I'm talking about regular folks like you and I and anyone else who might be part of the studies that I report on.
Are there, we've been talking about, you know, you've said that there is a limitation of just data going back to maybe some of the bias built into research that was done previously in terms of having enough data to look at homosexual couples in addition to heterosexual couples.
Right.
Do you see any foreseeable change in that?
Well, we've gone a long way, and the journals that I publish in and the ones that are relationship-focused have come a long way in publishing more and more research that's focused on non-heterosexual couples and particularly gay and lesbian couples. And I think we're going in the right direction. It's certainly not enough. And I would say that one of the parts that's kind of important about this is that there would be an interesting corollary here. So just this is a hypothesis that I have, but I don't have data to support this. What if it's the case that when both gay and lesbian couples begin courtship, that the person who is the pursuer tries to make more jokes and the person who is being pursued laughs? What if it's the case that basically this dynamic of joke producer and joke receiver is really about who is playing the pursuer and pursued role and less about, you know, your biological sex or your gender preference? So, or sexual preference, rather. So what I mean by that is, if you think about what's going on there, it could be that that humor at that early stage is really implanted in the role of performer or pursuer and less about being male.
Hmm. And we can't know that until we have that other data.
That's right. We need more good data to answer that question.
What will you be looking into next? It's always pretty fascinating. Last time we talked, I think you had studied how long it takes to make a friend, like how many hours?
Yeah. Well, I'm always interested in this idea of kind of everyday talk, like everyday interaction between people, the things that people share on daily events, you know, the ways in which that people bond with one another and become closer to one another. You know, what I'm currently working on is this idea of how do we integrate media. I'm writing a book right now on how we integrate personal media. So texting and phone calls and video chat and Facebook and Instagram and
what do you mean
all
by
of
integrate?
These things. Well, they're really part of our relationship tapestry. They're not separate. So there's been a kind of a growing awareness that the online and offline worlds are more mapped onto one another than separate from one another. So the idea here is the people who you communicate with the most on your phone are also the people who you communicate the most with face-to-face typically. Those who we value the most also tend to be the people who we reach out to the most if they're in long-distance situations, like a parent who lives far away or a close friend who lives on the coast. So the idea here is that my book is really about this broader sort of process of how do we relate to one another through technology, but also how do we sort of bond with one another at that sort of fundamental level? And that's where conversation comes in.
Jeffrey Hall with us from the Communication Studies Department at KU. Thanks so much.
It's always a pleasure. Thank you, Gina.
Jeffrey's most recent study shows that men undervalue humor in women and women overvalue humor in men in relationships. Up next, turns out Kansas was home to an early vegetarian settlement. We'll hear more. Stay tuned to KCUR's Central Standard. We're back. I'm Gina Kaufman. This is KCUR's Central Standard, and we're talking now about the history of vegetarianism because a fairly important chapter of that history took place in Kansas. My guest is Aaron Barnhart. Longtime listeners may remember him as the former TV critic for the Kansas City Star. Back then, he was a regular here on the 10 o'clock hour. Well, right now he is traveling internationally to research some of the earliest examples of vegetarianism, and it is super interesting stuff. Hi, Aaron.
Nice to be back, Gina. Hi.
Nice to have you back. I don't mean to reinforce stereotypes of Kansas, but from my experience traveling across the state and living on the eastern edge of it most of my life, I am honestly pretty surprised that it was home to an early vegetarian settlement.
Yeah. You know, the thing about Kansas in its early years, and this really starts with the beginning of white settlement in 1854, and really all the way through the populist party rise in the 1890s, is that Kansas was kind of a hothouse of all of these radical movements. And if you think about it, it's actually not that hard to imagine because Kansas was, before it was even a territory, it was an idea. And the idea was, this is the direction that slavery is going to go. It's going to go all the way to the Pacifics, Senator Acheson said, because we're going to bring it into the Union, we're going to have a vote on slavery, and we Missourians are going to win, and we're going to push it. So right from the beginning, Kansas was born. We like to emphasize, you know, the shooting and John Brown and all that, but it began with ideas, and from that point onwards, there has been a remarkable number of people coming out here with ideas for intentional communities and settlements, and so the work we're doing is sort of squarely in the middle of that.
You're working on a book about all of this with your wife, who is also a writer, Diane Eichhoff, and I understand the idea really emerged from her previous book about Clarinda Nichols. Can you explain that?
Yeah, so Clarinda was the woman who brought the women's movement west. She's one of the very first people in the women's rights movement in the 1840s and 50s. She's a newspaper publisher in Vermont. She brings she brings that out west, the movement. And in fact, the Kansas State Constitution has what was at the time leading, really the most liberal provisions for women baked into its charter. Diane was in the process of finishing that biography that we then published, and was looking for another story. And she comes across this account of a woman who came out with her extended family in about that same time, 1856. And she was part of a group of over 100 men, women, and children, all of whom had basically packed up their lives out east and come to a part of Kansas that no white person had ever settled in before. And it was all for the purpose of setting up a vegetarian colony. And so Diane really played with that. She left a journal behind. Spoiler alert, I guess it didn't go well for her family. But she left this really dramatic account behind. And so for many years, that was going to be the basis of it. But as she rewrote the manuscript a few times and we started to do our research travels, we realized that this was a larger story. And kind of like the women's rights movement before the Civil War, it's about a time in our American history that we've just completely overlooked.
There's some dominant narrative that emerged. And of course, like that whole history is written by the victors. That doesn't mean that no one else was around trying other things. I think the idea that like vegetarianism is some newish fad I like learning that there's this whole like scrappy history that goes way, way back.
Yeah. Scrappy is a nice word for it. Oddball is a word that often gets attached to it. I mean, we are not the first people to the story of the Kansas Vegetarian Settlement Company of 1856, as it was known. But most of the people who came to it before this were journalists and local historians, and they viewed these guys as kind of cranks and oddballs. And really, that's not very different from the way that certain editorial cartoonist depicted the women's movement at that time. The reality, Gina, is that vegetarianism, although a brand new movement, the name was coined in 1847. Even though it was a new movement, it was right in the slipstream with all of these other personal and societal improving reforms that a small but very influential group of people were starting to embrace at that time.
The working title for the book is Do Not Hurt, The Early Animal Rights Movement and 1856 Kansas Free State Vegetarian mm-hmm. Settlement. But where does that phrase, do not hurt, come from?
It comes from the person who was the brains behind the 1856 Kansas Vegetarian Colony, an Englishman who had been in the United States for 3 years named Henry Club. And Henry Club was there at the ground floor of the Vegetarian Society's formation. The vegetarian movement actually begins in England, in Manchester. It begins with, oddly enough, an intentional vegetarian community, sort of a precursor to the Kansas Colony over there in England. And Henry becomes its foremost advocate. By the time he comes to the United States, he's well known in those circles. And he will be influential for decades in this very early vegetarian movement. And Henry was a person whose earliest memories are of taking care of wounded animals and caring for what he calls inoffensive creatures. So from
caring for them in what way? Like,
well, mostly not eating them, but also not using them for sport. And so for Henry, vegetarianism, and he will always go out and say that, you know, he feels he's a robust man, he eats well, he's very healthy, he avoids all alcohol and tobacco, and he's very vigorous. And toward the end of his life, he would actually give newspaper shop out newspaper profiles of himself because he'd been a vegetarian for 60 years and he was still going strong. But at his core, it was not a health or lifestyle decision he made to be vegetarian. It was an ethical decision. And when he was trying to convey this to small children in the publications that he edited over the years, he really boiled it down to these three words held in a banner over the children's section of his vegetarian monthly. And it was called, and the words were very simply, do not hurt.
Why did you choose that for the title? What do you think it says about the larger sort of collection of stories that you have discovered and assembled?
Well, I should say, and this is kind of an insight into the process that Diane and I used when we're developing a book together, that's Diane's title.
Yeah.
And we'll still continue to talk about that before the book comes out. But what Diane really advocates is that you need to let people know right away, particularly the people who, when we elevator pitch this book, they get really excited about, I think, the aspect that there's this really old history to vegetarianism. Many people now are contemplating taking meat out of their diet, taking dairy out of their diet, and it fascinates them to hear that there's this earlier story and that the people who did it at the time didn't do it for health reasons. They really did it because they believed that this was an expression of what it was to be human, Gina. To be human was to not inflict needless suffering upon the inoffensive creatures that God gave to inhabit the earth along with yourself.
And it sounds like also a religious movement in part.
Yeah, absolutely. Although, you know, what constitutes a religious movement today and back then are kind of two different things. Henry Club was very friendly with all kinds of he himself belonged to the Swedenborgian Church, which was an outgrowth of the teachings of a very radical Christian mystic named Emanuel Swedenborg. But these people had dialogues with some of the other liberal reformers of the day, and many of these people would not be what we would call real Orthodox Christians. Some were spiritualists, and they tried to communicate with the departed. Transcendentalists, people who were really going into nature, like Ralph Waldo Emerson and Henry David Thoreau, Margaret Fuller. So these people all were kind of together with each other. And so even though some of them talked more in the language of God and wore the clerical collar like Henry did, they were really all of the sense that to elevate the human race and start to eliminate some of these social evils, such as alcohol and slavery, we were going to need to elevate ourselves. And actually, that's not too different from somebody like Jordan Peterson, right? Who in one of his 12 steps for life is get your own house in order before you try to change up society. These people really lived that.
You have been traveling to sites far beyond Kansas that have some significance in the history of vegetarianism, and I was particularly interested in the English church that you visited.
Yeah, the Bible Christian Church of Salford, England. Salford's a city right next to Manchester. It's part of Greater Manchester now. And in 1809, a Swedenborgian minister named William Cowherd, of all things, broke off and formed his own church because he believed that in addition to the teachings of Emanuel Swedenborg, that an observant Christian needed to abstain from animal products, animal foods. And so it was literally a vegetarian church. And this is in 1809.
That piece of the story does interest me, as does what has happened to this physical place since then.
Yes, yes. And we were delighted to hear, because this is actually our second visit to England, and back then we considered going up to Manchester to look at it, and they said, no, it's just a car park. There's nothing really there of interest.
Car park, a.k.a. parking lot.
A.k.a. parking lot. Yeah, British word economy. I love it. We visited other places, but then we heard that they were developing it into a park, that Greater Manchester and Salford have become a destination for people to live in, kind of like downtown Crossroads, Kansas City, and they're building up. And so as they build up, they need some green space. So they were reclaiming this car park, and that's when the archaeologists got involved. And they've done some historic preservation. It turns out William Cowherd was a really, really progressive guy in some ways. And so the working class, and this is key, you know, we like to think of vegetarianism as kind of this upper class thing that affluent people with time.
A luxury.
Yeah, a luxury that they can do. But back then it was a really working class movement, and Cowherd was a working class pastor. And literally they had people buried in the churchyard 6 and 7 bodies deep. And that's because Cowherd made a promise that if you were too poor to be buried by the Church of England, you could be buried at the Bible Christian Church. And they've uncovered literally thousands of graves on this little site. So we're looking forward to taking the book back to Salford when this is a fully developed historic site.
I mean, it sounds like what was once like a why would you want to see that, nothing there, kind of forgotten piece of history is being rediscovered by the local community and treated with some reverence.
Yeah.
But just starting now.
Yeah, we learned this when we were doing the first book on Clarinda Nichols. There's just nothing like going to the place where these people walked. And in the case of Clarinda Nichols, that involved just as much traveling because she starts her life in Vermont and ends up in California in addition to her 17 years in Kansas. And yet every time we went to these places of memory, right, just standing there made it shaped our conversations about what it meant to be living at that time, believing the things you did and taking the actions you do. I think it's just way too easy when you look back on previous times to kind of laugh and say, what were they thinking, all packing off to Kansas, you know, where there wasn't even a railroad, and just thinking that they could start growing corn and beans and whatnot and subsist as a vegetarian colony. These people were not dumb, and Club was nobody's fool. These people had a plan, and just because it didn't get pulled off, there were thousands of Kansas town settlements that ultimately failed. But I think what going to the place of where history happened does for you is it humbles you and makes you realize that these people were intelligent beings who wanted to change their world and the world around them. And you got to respect that.
Why didn't the Kansas settlement work?
Well, it wasn't because they ran out of food. That's been one theory we've seen even on signage put up by local historians. They had plenty of food. It wasn't because of the Indians. The Osage Indians historically were the power, you know, in this region. In the 1700s, they were the dominant political force, so much so that President Jefferson had to deal diplomatically with them. But they were always accommodating to the vegetarians. Really, what did them in was logistics and the sort of things you can't predict when you're planning any kind of a settlement in New York City or Boston. And most of those failed. Of course, the one great exception is Lawrence, Kansas, and they got a lot of infusions of money from Massachusetts to help keep that afloat, and even then, it almost didn't make it. So I would just say there are a number of factors that went into the failure of it, but in my mind, that was just a chapter in this early vegetarian movement.
You know, it is interesting when I think about the example in England. What was the name of that church again?
It was called the Bible Christian Church.
The fact that after it had existed and was this site with great significance to the story of vegetarianism, but that it had been turned into a parking lot, does that say something about how people saw this history?
You're right to focus on that because it is a terrific metaphor for everything that we do in history. It is just there's so much hidden history out there, and every generation tells the stories that they feel are important to them. And so for over a century, this wasn't important. I mean, let's face it, vegetarianism isn't one of the reasons we think about vegetarianism existing in the 1960s and 70s, and we don't think about it much before that, is that it did pretty much go dormant for several decades, really coincident with the death of Henry Club, who passes away in the early 20th century. Nobody sort of took the mantle after him. And then when it did come back, it was the Kellogg's and the health-minded people, and that's a whole different story somebody else can tell. This is our story, and we're looking forward to telling it.
Well, I'm Gina Kaufman. We're going to get right back to this conversation with Aaron Barnhart about the history of vegetarianism, what it has to do with Kansas, but also, very shortly, what it has to do with him. We'll be right back. I'm Gina Kaufman. This is KCUR Central Standard, and I've been chatting with Aaron Barnhart about a book he's working on with his partner, Diane Eickhoff. It has yet to be officially titled, but Do Not Hurt is the working title. And Aaron, do I understand right that you have become vegetarian over the course of working on this book?
We might be, in fact, the first two people to ever take up, actually, we've gone all the way to vegan, to adopt a plant-based diet while writing a book about somebody else on a plant-based diet. And we had not planned this or anything, but as I was saying before the break, the story initially began as the account of this woman and her journal about her experience, one might say ordeal, going west to Kansas and taking part of this vegetarian colony in 1856. As we rework the story, and anybody who's kind of reworked the story knows how this happens, characters start to emerge. Now, we're in nonfiction. We can't make stuff up about people. But as we began learning more about kind of the factors that led into this, the more kind of our directions turned toward Henry Club. And Henry Club, at the instigator of this settlement, lived for many years after the failure of the colony and was the mantle carrier for the American vegetarian movement in America in the latter half of the 19th century. And toward the end of his life, he wrote a book called 39 Reasons Why I'm a Vegetarian. And it's written in kind of antique language of the day. And every now and then we just sort of read it to kind of center ourselves and get some insights into Henry's character.
Yeah, like remind yourself where this is all coming from.
And I don't know, either Diane said it to me or I said it to her. You know, Henry's making a lot of sense here. and if we were to do this, we would not do it for health reasons. We're two relatively active and healthy people. This is not there. We don't have a lifestyle reason.
No one's prescribing this.
No one's prescribing it. And yet the ethical case just really became powerful to us. And we said, look, I mean, if we'll do this, and if it doesn't work out, we can always tell readers of our book, hey, we tried it, but, you know, Henry was really stalwart, and he knew how to persevere through all the challenges of going without animal products. But as it turns out, it's actually not been that hard for us. And I think the fact we're both doing it together also helps.
Do you remember, I mean, this is something that you've read a gazillion times. Is there one of these 19 reasons where, like, the particular phrasing of an old-timey language of why Henry Club chose to be a vegetarian, something that's extra compelling but also kind of shows that old-timey language of it?
Yes, yes. He says that a spiritual-minded man, so we already know it's old language because he refers, of course, to all humanity when he says man, but a spiritually-minded man does not brook the killing of inoffensive creatures for food because the very thought is repugnant to his nature. And that really, in a nutshell, is where Henry Club begins, not just his philosophy toward animals, but his philosophy toward all of life. He was very active in the peace movement. He was very active in the anti-slavery movement. This is a gentleman who predates the animal rights, you know, what we know as the SPCA and those early animal welfare organizations. Those don't happen until much later, the 1880s or so. Henry is really talking about what, for better lack of a better word, are the rights of animals in the 1850s.
And like how humans should conduct themselves.
Yes. So the idea is that, and this is a very Swedenborgian thought, but the more that you obey the laws of God in your daily life and perform acts of charity and kindness and do not hurt, the closer you can get to God, the more more godly you can be. So, again, it's this integration of private, personal spirituality and social reform. And the bridge is the act of charity. And Henry Club believed that it started with animals.
Okay, we did not ask for calls, but we have a listener who has something interesting to share. So I'm going to bring in Steve from Kansas City, who has surprised us. Steve, what do you have to share on this?
Well, I was very interested in hearing this show. I didn't hear the first part, but I had recently curated a bunch of articles from the 1850s from the American Phrenology Journal, which was a monthly newspaper of sorts, and it talks about a lot of things that you've mentioned. In fact, actually, I kind of curated a book, and it has articles in there mentioning Henry Club and the vegetarian settlement.
Fantastic. That's great.
And actually, my layer of this deals more with the phrenology aspect.
Yes.
My information has this, that it was called the Octagon and Vegetarian Settlement Company.
Okay, Aaron, you seem not very surprised that Steve has stumbled upon ads for this vegetarian colony and researching phrenology.
Steve, thank you for that call. I love it when I can get research tips on the air. And this is probably a good time to mention that my website, tvbarn.com, is still up and running. And there's a contact page in there, Steve, so if you please get a hold of me. But yes, phrenology was that practice which was surprisingly reputable for many years in the 19th century, of trying to determine a person's personality by feeling the bumps on their head.
And their aptitudes.
Yes, and their aptitudes, bumpology. Yeah. And so, yes, you could figure out if a person was romantic, if they were warm, if they were funny, if they were intelligent, kind of some of the things from the first segment of our show here. You could have figured out, allegedly, with a trained phrenologist running his hands over your skull.
With a lot of, as I understand it, people's own biases informing those determinations.
Yes, and so a lot of progressives, particularly in that day, right up to Abraham Lincoln, I guess he wasn't a progressive, but a lot of kind of liberal-minded people in that time subscribed to phrenology. Phrenology was also closely tied into health reform, specifically the water cure movement. You have to remember in the 18...
What is the water cure movement?
So in the 1800s, doctors are still doing things that were being done for centuries, bleeding, purging, purging, giving mercury to people, just all kinds of bad stuff. And this is about the time that people started to rebel against that. And they would go off to these rural retreats and they would drink cold, pure cold water and take baths and all that.
Yeah, just have a glass of water, man.
And they would get well. And that was a risky proposition in the ever overcrowded cities of 1800s America. So these people really were escaping all of that, and that's where phrenology, health cure, and the water cure were tailored to a surprisingly mainstream audience, and Henry Club just slipped right in there with his vegetarian agenda. It's a fascinating story.
And one that seems to have really won you over. I love that, like, Henry Club, centuries later, has convinced you to try it.
Yeah, we're very excited about bringing this out in 2020, so looking forward to that.
Aaron Barnhart, thanks so much.
Thank you for having me on, Gina.
Aaron has been sending out missives about the research he and his wife and collaborator Diane Eickhoff have been doing about the history of the vegetarian movement, and we'll have to talk more when the book is out. Our time is up for today, but anything you might have missed from this morning's show will be available online by the end of the day at kcur.org/centralstandard. That's where we archive all of these conversations, kcur.org/centralstandard. Tomorrow, we'll talk about how companies are recruiting young workers today as compared to how they lured their workforce in previous generations. Can that tell us anything about our changing economy, our changing values? Tune in for that discussion tomorrow at 10. Central Standard is produced by Melody Rowell with Ann Kniggendorf, Aviva Okeson-Haberman, Chris Young, and intern Riley Kester. Sylvia Maria Gross is our senior producer. I'm Gina Kaufman. Up to Date is next.